Welcome to Legal Ethics, Effective and Ethical Use of Experts. My name is Wendy Patrick, and we are going to be taking a look at some of the ethical issues surrounding one of the most frequently encountered issues in any type of case, whether or not to use an expert witness. Now, deciding whether or not to use an expert witness is only the beginning of the analysis. There are so many issues that arise. Whether you're defending a matter, whether you are the plaintiff, whether you're a prosecutor, whatever kind of law you practice, the ethics of using expert witnesses is going to be important, probably more so every year as we learn more about what kind of significant subfields of expertise that often crop up in expert witness testimony. And we're going to look at some of the rules. We're going to look at the model rules, the ABA rules, standards. Probably more than you'll need to know in your particular case, but consider this good reference material should any of these issues come up for you. The very first question that lawyers always ask is, when do I need an expert? Now, ideally, you may have precipient witnesses, maybe investigators in your case, or other kinds of witnesses that can provide very valuable information for a jury or a judge. And if that's true, I mean, lucky you in court not having to spend the money to consult with or actually obtain an outside expert. But that's not always the case. And in fact, sometimes when you learn the other side is paying for an expert, you almost feel obligated to explore that option yourself. And then follow up on it. You know, many cases involve a battle of the experts. We know this is true, not only in our own practice, but if any of you follow the high profile cases around the country, you will see that oftentimes issues come down to expert testimony. They involve issues beyond the scope of common understanding, beyond the judges, the juries, the lawyers, and that's why we have expert witnesses. What ends up coming up more frequently ethically is what kind of expert should we use, how thoroughly should we vet their expertise, and then credibility counts. Because remember, as officers of the court, we have a duty to only put forth truthful, accurate evidence. And that's one of the reasons that it's almost incumbent upon us to learn as much as we can proactively about not only the issues in dispute, but what kind of expert testimony may be necessary for our client. That's not only reflected in the rules, but it's also reflected in common practice. So those of us that go to court all of the time are very familiar with judges questioning not only the selection of experts, but the accuracy, the truthfulness, the ability of the other side to, through cross-examination, through voir dire of an expert, to be able to break down the issues that are going to be necessary for the jury, for example, to assign respective weight to different expert testimony. But from the very beginning, one of the things we want to decide is it worth it to get an expert, or do we have everything we need by virtue of the witnesses we already plan to call? So once the preliminary question is asked, we have to decide, well, how are we going to answer it? How are we going to break it down and analyze whether or not we need to actually go out and find an expert? Now, here is the way it's broken down federally. We look at the fact that if scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge, italics mine, will assist the trier of fact to understand the evidence or determine a fact and issue. Let's just stop right there. We all get the reality that scientists and technical experts and forensic experts and all the different kinds of experts we call, we're used to those types of professionals being called as experts. But look at these words, other specialized knowledge. Now, we've all probably called experts that don't have 5 degrees after their names, but do have practical experience that qualifies them legally to explain to the jury how things work, how things are done, what you might have expected. I mean, think about everyone from mechanical experts to plumbers to electricians. You can think of so many different fields of expertise, people that don't even have college degrees that have specialized knowledge that can assist the trier of fact. So there is nothing about credentials that guarantees credibility, either in the eyes of the court or the eyes of the jury, for that matter. And nor is that required under the evidence code section. Look at the last part of this rule. It says a witness qualified as an expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, again, italics mine, or education may testify thereto in the form of an opinion or otherwise. You know, sometimes people say, well, you know, you've got to look at a resume of an expert. And it's by looking at the resume that you learn a little bit more about how credible they're going to be. And, you know, just because I like arguing both sides of anything, think about time spent in earning a degree versus actually doing the work that you're testifying about. There have been plenty of experts that have spent their entire lives in a certain industry, maybe not getting advanced degrees, MDs or PhDs, or sometimes even college degrees or master's degrees, but have absolutely been immersed in the field that they're testifying about. They didn't waste a minute. So in terms of qualifying as an expert, these are all things to consider. Now, ideally, you'll have both. You'll have somebody that has impeccable credentials and great work experience, belongs to all the right associations, but not always, and not always within your budget. There are so many different issues to decide and discuss with your client at the front end of making the decision whether or not to call an expert. Now, if you look at the advisory committee notes to this rule, it talks about the reality that most of the literature makes an assumption. And that assumption is that experts are testifying only in the form of opinions. But it goes on to say an expert may give a dissertation or exposition of scientific or other principles that are relevant to the case. That's really important. You've heard of blind experts, no doubt. You probably call them in your cases. There are experts who can greatly assist the trier of fact in your case by talking generally about a specific field of expertise, a specific field that goes above and beyond what your jurors would know, what your judge would know, probably what you know. And these are the kinds of experts that you ought to consider, not just sometimes consulting with them, but actually putting them on the stand. Very valuable information, even if they cannot reach an ultimate conclusion in the facts of your case. Many of us have served as these types of expert witnesses that are able to relay information generally that then the jury or the judge can apply to whatever facts that you have. So going back to when you need an expert, it's experience and expertise beyond the judge and what the jury might have. It's also to explain the normalcy of unexpected behavior. Now, let me take a minute and talk about this, because there are lots of you that may handle cases that involve interpersonal issues. Maybe it's a family law case, maybe it's a sexual assault or child abuse or neglect, whatever it is, you have unexpected behavior, probably not unexpected to anybody that's been in the same scenario, but you can't always guarantee you're going to have a judge or a jury that is able to directly relate to your client's experience, to, if you're representing a victim, to the victim's experience. We often retain experts to explain to juries why people might behave the way they do under certain circumstances. They reframe what sometimes is referred to as counterintuitive as consistent. In other words, it's not counterintuitive behavior for a sexual assault victim not to call the police right away or to continue to interact socially with the perpetrator. In a family law scenario, it is not counterintuitive or inconsistent for family members to continue to interact and compartmentalize abuse in order to survive. These are the types of things that sometimes we need experts to explain, because unless a jury or a judge has direct experience, they might think it's odd that somebody didn't run right to the police or at least report the behavior somewhere. So what is beyond common experience mean? In these types of instances, you're looking at understanding things like delayed disclosure, decision to report, explaining what we call survival behavior. And then when you look at who can be an expert, it talks about any witness with that special knowledge skill. It's only error legally if you've got a witness that clearly lacks qualifications as an expert. So let me give you sort of an aside here. There have been many cases in many different types of law where there have been experts that have lacked the scientific backing, foundation. They don't have any peer review articles behind their name. More than that, though, the basis, the foundation on which they're anchoring their expertise is shaky at best. If you have experts like that in trial, in court, and for whatever reason, a judge allows this type of testimony, you may have an argument that that is not a valid use of expert testimony. Should the lawyer have known better than to put that expert on? Now, I'm going to show you a series of standards under the ABA. And although standards themselves are not binding authority like state bar rules are, remember the duty of candor and all the rest of that we're going to go through, those are state bar rules. But it's always good advice to look at everything, all of the guidance in the area of who and what kind of people we should be calling upon to provide expert testimony in front of a judge or jury. Now, best case scenario, you may not know, you may kind of find out after the fact, and maybe the testimony is excluded. Worst case scenario, you have verdicts that are undermined and are that lack the credibility and consistency that we might like because they're not based on solid expert testimony. Sometimes both sides call experts that fall into that category, but there's a bit of a duty of investigation on our part before we put somebody on the stand. We don't want to create a problem. Now, what kind of experts do we normally call? Well, normally when we think about experts, we think about somebody that maybe works in the community, at a crime lab, law enforcement, academics. We always have academic experts because they are experts. They know way more about the subject matter than the rest of us. There are some kinds of experts that are disfavored just in terms of credibility and chemistry is probably the best way to put it. So on the upper left, you've got the ivory tower expert. This is the doesn't necessarily need to be an academic, but normally it's somebody that has a very good, very impressive degrees, but very impressive resume, went to a great school, but talks down to the jury to the extent that they lose the ability to sort of ingratiate themselves and endear themselves to the trier of fact in a way that would benefit your client. Now, Bob Barker here in The Price is Right, this is a little flashback from my childhood. This was a great show where you sometimes saw that game show hosts have a certain role to play, and they're often very showmanlike. That doesn't always play well in front of a jury either. I had a case, and actually it's more than one case, where I've had experts actually get off the witness stand, go walk in front of the jury box, and put on a show. And, you know, nobody quite knows what to do. You know, sometimes there's an objection from one of the two lawyers, and judge really doesn't have to work it out because an expert by definition is there to demonstrate something beyond common experience, but it sometimes is odd. Fortune teller expert is also, you've got to be very careful with this because judges and juries are wary of somebody that comes in and attempts to be able to predict the future. I mean, sure, there are studies that show consistent patterns and you can always find trends and statistics, but that doesn't ever mean that you can guarantee your clients or the victim or the plaintiff or the defendant or whoever it is that's being analyzed is going to fall within that range. It's just speculation according to some jurors. And in fact, these are areas you want to wide ear on as well, because there are many juries that just aren't buying it when it comes to psychologists or statisticians or economic advisors or anybody that's going to be making predictions based on trends. And then, of course, you don't ever want an expert that's going to come across as a snake oil salesman. Now, how do you know? You know, many people ask me, you know, gosh, you decide who to put on the stand, you read resumes, you know, there's always some value in getting prior transcripts. But I have to tell you, having spent about 25 years, over 25 years getting prior transcripts, the value of attempting to impeach a smart expert on a prior transcript decreases with the length of time the expert has been practicing their trade, because they know enough to simply say their opinion has changed. And in fact, if anything, they come across as progressive in front of the jury. Look, this is somebody that is candid enough and credible enough to sort of update and refresh their opinion as times change, as new studies come out. So we don't necessarily, although sometimes they are valuable, but it's not necessarily the end of the story if you have transcript testimony that's going to be used to impeach your expert or that you can use to impeach the other side's expert. Okay, so these are some of the, let's just say, areas in which you want to exercise a little bit of caution in deciding what kind of expert to use. Having the opportunity to watch an expert testify has to be one of the best ways to decide whether or not an expert is going to be good for your case. It's also a great way to gauge expert credibility, because ethically, this is one of the things you care most about. Whether or not you have an expert that is credible, that is believable, whose opinions are technologically sound, evidentiarily sound, the foundations are strong, and watching and listening, and especially when you also get to watch cross-examination, this is one of the best ways you actually decide who is and isn't a good expert witness. Now, you may practice in a large jurisdiction, and if that's true, wherever in the country you live, you'll have more opportunity to listen to particular experts to decide whether or not you want to call them in your case. Smaller jurisdictions, you may have to travel to see one of these experts. But I have to say one thing, post-pandemic, one of the blessings, one of the silver linings of having really gone virtual to such an extent is you may be able to watch virtually in many courthouses. I mean, there are lots of opportunities. You can just log on to the courthouse website and watch the proceedings in one of the departments. What better way to watch an expert witness testify from the comfort of your office? Doesn't cost you anything to get there. So these are some options we have now that we didn't have in years past. Always the best way to choose an expert witness. All right, so there are some pretty unusual experts out there. And I just thought I would give you a short list just so you could appreciate the extent to which the rules really allow anybody with specialized knowledge to potentially qualify. There are experts on dog behavior. Gemologists, for those of you that want to have your jewelry appraised. Lip reading experts. Meteorologists. Okay, I live in sunny Southern California. We always say it's a pretty good gig to be a meteorologist here because you normally have to just say the same thing every day. Sunny and mild. But it's interesting to look at the variety of expert witnesses that are out there just to give you an idea of what your judge is going to allow. You know, as a young lawyer, I began my career as a defense attorney and then, of course, became a prosecutor. But I remember back in the day, back in the 90s, thinking that, well, surely a judge is not going to allow this particular person to testify as an expert. And I was absolutely shocked and amazed back in the day that judges who had been practicing far longer than I had already knew the rules. And they, of course, knew that anything that was going to be able to assist the trier of fact, usually the jury, was admissible. And if I wanted to argue that this is unusual or that many people don't employ experts like this, well, that was just something that went to wait. Nowadays, I appreciate the fact that I can never automatically assume anybody isn't going to potentially qualify as an expert, depending on how much they know about some unusual aspect of whatever is at issue in the case. Now, I'll give you one more example. Here in my neck of the woods, we have earthquakes. And every time we have an earthquake, you see the same experts on television breaking down the when, the why, the how. So too in your jurisdictions, if you live in places where there are floods, tornadoes, and hurricanes, you probably have the same thing on your local television. Fields of expertise are very, very common. And that's even more so when you have these niche practices that are uniquely geared to the facts of your case. So never rule out the opportunity to bolster your case by using an expert or ways in which you can maybe use an expert to even consult with to help you to be able to cross-examine the other side's expert as well. Now, having said all of that, let's plug in some of the most useful professional standards. Now, I've already been talking about one of them. Obviously, you want to make sure that you're in compliance with your state's standard of competence. That's always rule 1.1. All of our states have adopted the ABA rules now exactly the same way. Competence talks about legal competence. You have to know what's going on. You have to be well-versed in the field. In some of our states, you need to also have emotional competence, physical, mental. But one thing you do have to do is make sure that your state adopted ABA Rule 1.1 in a fashion that you understand, because it's up to you to know the rules and to know the law and to know the competence rule to the effect that you're not out of your league in selecting the expert you're going to use in your case. Always, always important. And it's also important the relationship that you have with your expert. Now, many of you remember the beloved film, My Cousin Vinny, that included just so many different snippets and vignettes that are useful in so many areas of the law. So you're probably not going to be calling your fiance as an expert witness, but you might be calling someone with whom you have a prior relationship. Well, are there any rules that govern when you can do that? Well, there is a conflict of interest rule that's always important, because we live in a day and age where conflicts are common, especially if you come from a small jurisdiction where not only does everybody know everyone, but you probably work with the same players all of the time. If you work with law enforcement, there are probably the same crime lab analysts or maybe the same coroners that are coming to court to testify. In the civil realm, you may have the same accident reconstructionists or medical experts. In other words, you may have pre-existing relationships with these people. Does that mean that you can't use them as experts? Well, here's what the rule says. It just says a lawyer shall not represent a client if the representation involves a concurrent conflict of interest. And then they talk about what that means. And, you know, I'm going to spare you all of the concurrent clients and all the rest of it. But one of the things it talks about is if there's a significant risk, the representation will be materially limited by a third person or a personal.
Esquire CLE's first verification code is TON, T-O-N, all lowercase, TON. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TON, T-O-N, all lowercase, TON. Please take a moment and write this down.
Interest of the lawyer. Now, why do I show you this? Because most people, when they think about conflicts of interest, they immediately think about, oh, representing two clients whose interest might be adverse. There is so much more to the conflict of interest rule than simply that. It talks about you being conflicted. It's sort of like when a motion is made to recuse a judge. There's something about personal relationships, personal interests that could, in some cases, compromise a client's interest. So this is one of those rules that it's just helpful to know the way it's phrased. So for example, if you personally had an interest in the outcome of the case, maybe it's an environmental case and you have stock in one of the companies that's suing or being sued, that would probably also be true no matter what kind of a products liability case it was. If you have a personal interest in the outcome, these are the kinds of things you want to watch out for, just in case anybody makes this type of an argument. Now, we know they do, because when we follow the high-profile cases nationwide, I would say both legally and politically, we know that conflict of interest is something that is frequently raised. So you just want to make sure that there's no conflict between you and whoever you decide to use as an expert witness. Now, there are also ABA standards. There are standards for prosecution function and defense function. I'm going to talk about the defense function ones here in this program, but it gives you an idea. It doesn't matter whether or not you practice criminal defense, although these standards are sort of geared towards that type of practice, because the concepts are clearly useful no matter what kind of case you are defending, what kind of client you are representing. You'll see what I mean in a minute when you talk about the types of things that are discussed. The first thing that is discussed is what we started out with. Why do you think you need an expert? Do you want a report? Do you want somebody to actually take the stand, somebody that's going to be evaluated in front of the jury. They're going to have great demeanor and make eye contact and speak in common parlance and all the rest of what goes along with testifying? Or do you simply want somebody to consult with to help you become competent per Rule 1.1 in putting on that case? So there may be a variety or a mix of reasons that you've decided you want an expert. But you should know the relevant rules governing expert witnesses. Here's a very important part, no matter what kind of case you're trying, including possibly different disclosure rules governing experts who are engaged for consultation only. Now, because I know I'm speaking to a wide variety of different types of practitioners, consider what those rules would be for you. When you receive expert witness testimony, let's say it's testimony that you think is inconsistent with another witness you consulted with, or maybe you consult with a witness that you never put on the stand, but you learned information that is inconsistent with the rest of the evidence in your case. What kind of obligation, if any, do you have? Many of you wouldn't, depending on what kind of a case you are handling. Some of you in the criminal realm would, depending on who you intend to call during the course of your trial. But it's important to note that this is an issue for you to think about when you are consulting with expert witnesses, probably deciding whether or not to call them to the stand. Are you creating discovery? That is also a question you want to ask yourself when you are deciding how much information and what kind of information you want to provide to your expert in order for them to render an opinion. Because you'll be asked about that. The expert will be asked about that when the expert testifies. What did you rely on? What did you read? And lots of times experts actually put that in their report. So there may be cases where you don't give over private, sensitive, confidential information because you don't want to make it discoverable. Now, sometimes you have to. Sometimes it's facts of the case and the rules say you have to turn it over, but not always. You can't always fall back on a work product privilege in every single type of case simply because you don't want the expert to talk about some of the information you provided. Very important to round table and brainstorm these issues within your law firm, whatever kind of brainstorming group you belong to. I know sometimes industries have listservs that they use to sort of hook up like-minded practitioners to sort of hash out issues, not case specific necessarily, but just legal issues, evidentiary issues. But you want to make sure you're not inadvertently making something discoverable when that was not your intention. So the relationships that we have with our expert witnesses, this is really important in any type of case before engaging your expert. It says defense counsel, but this, I mean, every lawyer should be doing this, should investigate the expert's credentials, relevant professional experience, and reputation in the field. Now, without disclosing any particular cases, let me just say that many of us have had the misfortune, wishing we had done more investigation on the front end, of learning that expert witnesses have backgrounds. They have a past, just like anybody else. And sometimes that past includes misconduct, criminal convictions for moral turpitude, and other types of behavior that obviously is relevant for cross-examination should a judge allow it, but that you wouldn't necessarily believe is there. So you've got to look. There is nothing about someone that has an advanced degree that means they don't also potentially have a criminal past. Many times there are professional sanctions. There's not only professional discipline, but there are different types of legal cases and convictions. Now, they may involve moral turpitude and not even be felony conduct. So there's a lot that a judge might want to know, that your opposing counsel will probably discover, that you might have an obligation to reveal, depending on whatever it is, what kind of case you handle, what kind of lawyer you are. But we want to do this diligence, this due diligence on the front end to make sure that we've explored all those potential areas. Now, another reason we want to investigate the expert credentials is, remember, we have a duty of competence. we have a duty to put on competent evidence. And it's somebody that looks good on paper, as we say, we want to make sure we investigate whatever kinds of organizations they belong to, what kinds of schools they went to, whatever kind of professional designations they hold, because you don't need to look very far on the nightly news to know that those things can be easily misrepresented. Now, I don't believe we should be completely paranoid with everybody we ever consult with or consider putting on the stand. It's just good practice to familiarize yourself, because guess what? Your opposing counsel is going to be doing it. So you're going to want to be able to come back on redirect and rehabilitate an expert if they've been impeached through whatever it is on their resume that maybe in reality is a little bit different than the way it appeared. Reputation in the field is important as well. Many cases that involve multiple experts obviously are going to involve not only a battle of the expert, but oftentimes a battle of the expert reputation. Peer review is very important for this reason. You'll have cross-examination questions, and I've of course spent 25 years with battle of the expert cases, and I'm very familiar with the cross-examination question. Well, doctor, isn't it true that most of your colleagues disagree with you? Now, obviously, you can imagine many of those questions are objectionable, but not all my objections get sustained. Not all yours do either. Depends on the judge. And it also depends on the extent to which you've been able to develop your witnesses' expertise on the front end, to where you're not ever accused of putting on someone that you had no reason to believe was going to provide accurate, reliable testimony. No, because you'll have done the legwork to at least convince yourself that this is somebody that qualifies legally and evidentiary wise as a good expert witness. Now, relevant professional experience is important as well. You may recall that many times you'll have experts on the stand that are attacked, not because they don't have the right credentials, but because they've never actually done the work. That was my point earlier about you can go straight from high school into college and earn a degree, or you can go straight out into the field and get 4 years of practical experience. I guess young people are in college more than 4 years nowadays. Many of us have parents that would only pay for four. But the point is, sometimes experience matters, depending on why the expert is giving the testimony. Knowing about research studies is great, but it all comes down to a mix of empirical and anecdotal evidence in front of a jury. And they are going to want somebody that's actually walked the walk at the end of the day. So you want to make sure you have an expert that can talk the talk and walk the walk. Relevant professional experience in the field. Now, the reason we want to look at background and credentials for potential impeachment issues is especially if you have a practice where you repeatedly try the same types of cases. You'll be able to spot some of these things because you've seen it before. That is a wonderful position to be in when you are familiar with certain kinds of issues because you've had them come up in another type of case. Now, another way you can do this is watch your colleagues in trial. Zoom in or Microsoft Teams or whatever different courtrooms are using and watch other kinds of trials where experts are being used that are the same kind of expert you want to use. There is just no substitute for actually watching these kinds of proceedings. Watch voir dire. Think about how you can create your own voir dire questions for a prospective jury panel based on what you already know are going to be some of the issues that they're going to be having to grapple with during the course of your trial. So you're going to want to use the same kinds of tricks and tactics and strategies in breaking down the opposing expert's resume on the front end to decide what you're going to be using for impeachment purposes. There's no such thing as an expert witness that is unimpeachable. You know, we like to say that, oh, that's an unimpeachable witness, but that's never true. There's always something. Sometimes it's not necessarily a credential or an issue of experience. Sometimes it's in the fashion that they testify. Sometimes it's in a demeanor, somebody that is absolutely unwilling to admit that they might be wrong in a certain circumstance. Now, on the other side of that coin, and many of us have had it both ways, we have a witness that's really never sure about giving a definitive answer as to their opinion. They can never be sure to a medical certainty, psychological certainty, forensic certainty. And I understand, you know, that's a cautious way to approach testimony or writing a report or giving you an opinion, but that could potentially be an area of weakness that your opposition will exploit. No easy answers for how to handle all of this, but it's a good idea to know and to be able to strategize this right from the beginning. So that, for example, you may want to voir dire your jury panel on whether or not they expect to hear an expert opine with absolute certainty, or whether or not they'd be willing to consider an expert's testimony against the weight of the rest of the evidence, the rest of the story, as we like to say. So we have this duty of investigation of the expert and of the area of expertise, but we also may have a duty to look at the scientific acceptance of the theory, the method, the conclusions about what the expert would testify. Because imagine this from an ethical perspective. Do you want to be called out as having proffered an expert that, had you done the requisite amount of research, you would learn the science that they're using to anchor their opinion is basically junk, quote unquote? There are lots of cases that are out there, lots of published decisions that have dealt with the realities of somebody finding an expert that looks good, sounds good, seems to have all the credentials, testifies well, you know, dresses well, looks good in front of the jury, that when they really looked back on what are you basing this opinion on, we're sometimes horrified to find that it's something that is not even accepted in the field of expertise. So we don't just want to look at the person, the testimony. We also want to look at the generalized scientific acceptance of the theory, the method, or the conclusion. Because if at the very least, a court's going to ask us what kind of research we did. Now, not always. Some of you may think, boy, I've never asked about that yet. Practice long enough, my friends, and you will be asked about how you found this type of an expert. Why? Because courts are very concerned about misleading a jury. They're concerned about themselves being misled if it's a bench trial or a non-jury proceeding. No one wants misleading testimony. Nobody wants testimony that is unreliable, that's unscientific, that's not credible, that's not consistent, that shouldn't be the kind of evidence that's being used to support your client's case. So that's one of the reasons it's very important to look into all of this. Now, the reason why this is also important, learning about the substantive area of expertise, is we also want to look at the expert's ethical rules. What kind of expertise do they have? And what ethical rules are they bound by? Now, this is huge. Okay, earlier I said there are some people that can be testifying as experts, but don't really have an industry, they don't have credentials, maybe they didn't go to college, they didn't go get an MD, PhD, master's, whatever it is. If that's true, they're not bound by industry ethical rules because they don't technically belong to the industry. They don't have a license in whatever it is, whatever the field of expertise. I'll give you a perfect example, the psychology arena or the medical field. Now, there are medical ethics, psychological ethics by the APA that people have to abide by, or their own licenses are in trouble. Just like as lawyers, our state bar license might be in trouble if we don't abide by our own ethical rule. So the beauty of researching this is if you know what their ethical standards are, you're going to be in a great position to decide whether or not what they're testifying about is in conformity with what they're allowed to say. This is a huge cross-examination tool, as you might imagine, as well. Many of us routinely go to court armed not only with the law and the evidence code, but with our own ethical code, our model rules of professional responsibility, and the ethical rules that govern the experts that are going to be testifying in the case. Now, you may assume, well, obviously, all experts are aware of their ethical rules. Not always. And it is very intimidating sometimes to an expert to see that opposing counsel has come to court carrying the ethical rules that govern what the expert is supposed to know and abide by. You can imagine what they're going to be doing on their first break if they are not as familiar with their own ethical rules as you are. So these are some of the things that just give you that extra edge ethically in not only deciding what you can and can't elicit from any particular expert, whether on cross or on direct examination, but how you may be able to use the ethical rules within the field of expertise that you have on the stand in order to help your client's case. Okay, so just I gave you the example earlier about survivor behavior being a just sort of an easy example that everybody understands because everybody has been through trauma. And I'm going to use this very generally because, I mean, it's traumatic to slip and fall in a grocery store. It's traumatic to be in an auto accident. You don't need to be a sexual assault victim to appreciate the extent to which people react differently. You know, I bring up tort case law a lot because many times people like to film tort plaintiffs, you know, on the tennis court when they broke an ankle or maybe out, you know, at a social event when they lost a spouse or a child. And then you have experts that come in and say, not everybody responds differently to trauma. It's an easy example that demonstrates the kind of expert that may be able to talk interpersonally. Delayed disclosure was the other one I gave. This is not necessarily only in the field of criminal law, but lots of times defective products are not called in right away, if you will, or not reported right away, or somebody holds on to them for a while. There are lots of reasons why people respond differently. And if you represent a plaintiff or a client of any kind, you may think through whether or not there may be a need for somebody to explain the delay. Why not get on the phone right away? I mean, any of us that have been on hold for any appreciable amount of time know the answer to that instinctively, because who knows how long it's going to get to take you to actually get an answer, whatever you're trying to do. But one other reason that you might want to consider expert testimony is because the statistics that are out there, whatever kind of case you're handling, are not always applicable to your victim. You may have a young professional, for example, that doesn't react the way that somebody that is maybe over 50 would react, or hasn't grown up with the same mindset or viewpoint that would prompt certain types of responsive behavior. And so the statistics that exist maybe were done on populations 10 years ago, 20, 30 years ago, and wouldn't necessarily apply to the younger generation. There are so many things to consider, which is why you might want to consider, do I need an expert to explain the way Gen Z would react to this kind of a case or this kind of a fact pattern, or why they may not follow the kinds of protocol or react in the same way somebody would 30 years ago. Statistics can only predict so much. And preparing your expert for court has to include all of what we've discussed so far, including the reality that they're going to be asked about things like delayed disclosure, statistics, the kinds of studies they relied on, scientific acceptability in their particular field of expertise of whatever it is that they relied on. These are the types of things that they no doubt already know if they're seasoned experts. But if you're planning on calling somebody to the stand that maybe isn't a seasoned expert, maybe you have a case where you're using someone that doesn't have 20 years of experience, you're going to need to prepare them for court. Now, managing expectations. We all know we can't tell an expert what to say, but we can tell them what to expect. Many times there are procedural aspects of the testimony, preparing to testify, taking the stand, cross-examination, that can very much put an expert at ease, especially if maybe you found them, they're outside of your jurisdiction. You don't want them to become wary of the way you do things in your small town. Nobody wants to be hometown and nobody wants to be surprised. We manage our own expectations when we appear in a courtroom we're unfamiliar with. We go to the clerk and say, you know, does the judge let us use the well? Did the judge prefer us to stand? Will we make objections? Usually the answer is yes. There's lots of ways in which we manage our own expectations in going to court. There's no reason why our expert won't be put at ease by knowing what they can expect when they go to court. It's the same way we would do with a client or a victim. You know, we take them, we show them the courtroom, what's going to happen, who stands and who sits where, who's going to be there. Is it completely public? Is it a live streamed courtroom where anybody could be watching from anywhere in the world? Or is it an old school courtroom where you probably aren't going to have that many people in the gallery? Managing expectations also manages emotions, and it can very much put an expert at ease. Remember, knowledge is power, and even if it's a case where they are going to have to prepare for a lot of people watching, better they know that in advance than at the spur of the moment when they come in the door of the courtroom. Now, one of the biggest ethical issues for us, for lawyers, all lawyers in all kinds of cases, is our experts' transparency, credibility, and candor. Now, here's what the candor in the courtroom rule says. Look at the way it's phrased. And by the way, all of our states have adopted one of the iterations of 3.3, usually verbatim. A lawyer shall not knowingly, very important, make a false statement of fact or law to a court, or fail to correct a false statement of material fact or law previously made to the court by the lawyer. Now, obviously, this includes, and it goes on to include, a lot of other subdivisions in a lot of other areas. But here's the gist of 3.3. Knowingly. Now, you may argue, well, you can infer knowledge through circumstances. We say that all the time when it comes to candor in the courtroom. You can't just say, well, I didn't know, when by all accounts, there's no way you shouldn't have known. That becomes not negligence, but recklessness to the degree that it becomes misrepresentation. At least that's the way the argument goes. But if you come to know after the fact that evidence, that testimony was false, well, you have a duty to clean it up. If you learn of the falsity, here's what the rule says you have to do. Take reasonable remedial measures, including, if necessary, disclosure to the court. As a practical matter, most lawyers choose that route. They tell the court what happened. You may have an expert, and this happens more frequently than you might imagine. You have experts that, unbeknownst to you, take the stand and go way beyond what you thought they were going to say. In other words, they don't just give the trier of fact what was in their report, what they told you about, the conversations that you had with the experts, but they then begin to editorialize and embellish to the extent that you become uncomfortable. If that happens, if that's true, there are many lawyers that actually bring that up on a break in chambers, on or off the record, usually on the record, to make sure that they make a good record and let the court know what happened. And then everybody discusses what to say about it. You know, sometimes in cross-examination, the other side is able to get up and say, you know, isn't it true this is way beyond what was in your report, or this is the first time you testified to this, or whatever it is. But there are other remedial measures the court may decide to take. It all depends on the facts of your case, but know that this language is there and is there for you to use and rely on if you need to. Also goes back to that word knowingly. But here, think about the other side of this for a minute. What if you really don't know? Well, if you don't know, but you should have known that certain testimony was false, unreliable, or misleading, well, are you now in violation of Rule 1.1, the duty of competence? So to not know whatever it is that you should have known could result in you defaulting into a 3.3 violation duty of candor or a 1.1 violation duty of competence. Best not to default anywhere and just be straight on the path to victory for your client, because you've done the legwork at the beginning of the case to familiarize yourself with whatever field of expertise is at issue. And here's another thing that 3.3 allows you to take into consideration. You have the ability, if you choose, to refuse to offer evidence unless you represent a criminal defendant, if you believe that the evidence is going to be false. Now, you may come to that belief shortly before court. that's okay. You know, this happens. This happens in a lot of different types of cases. You may learn something. You may have opposing counsel tip you off to something.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is RYE, R-Y-E, all lowercase, RYE. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is RYE, R-Y-E, all lowercase, RYE. Please take a moment and write this down.
I mean, their goal is to keep your expert off the stand if it's something that's really going to harm their side of the case. There is no reason to ever discount information that may come into your possession. Always read it and consider it and decide whether or not it has any kind of merit. If it does, you may refuse to offer evidence that you reasonably believe is false. Now, besides 3.3, Rule 4.1 talks about truthfulness in statements out of the courtroom, in and out of the courtroom. It doesn't necessarily need to happen at a court or an ancillary proceeding like a deposition. Look at the way this is phrased. In the course of representing a client, so much more broadly, a lawyer shall not knowingly make a false statement of material fact or law to a third person or fail to disclose a material fact to a third person when that is necessary to avoid assisting a criminal or fraudulent act by a client. And then the disclaimer is, of course, unless it's prohibited by 1.6, which is the duty of confidentiality. So we talk about sins of commission and sins of omission. You cannot fail to disclose a material fact when that disclosure would have been necessary not only to put something in context, but to avoid assisting a criminal or fraudulent act by a client. So truthfulness in statements, this would even apply, for example, to negotiations, to representations about what your expert is going to say, about the field of expertise, anything that involves you relating information has to be done truthfully. It's also true that even 8.4 talks about misconduct in terms of credibility and truthfulness. Now, you may be familiar with the criminal act exception, which basically says lawyers cannot not only not violate rules of professional conduct, but can't commit any kind of a crime that affects honesty or fitness as a lawyer, or engage in conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. But when you think about the way these rules apply to what kind of an expert you're going to put on the stand, many times there's been a lot of study that's been done on why do lawyers find themselves with this ethical dilemma with an expert witness who seems to be embellishing testimony. Now, it may not be testimony. Maybe it's what they put in their report. Maybe it's the extent to which they represent what you should or shouldn't do in cross-examining the other side's expert. But it's interesting to see how does this happen and why do lawyers find themselves getting crosswise with this duty of candor with a particular expert? What is it that creates this temptation to embellish? I'll just give you a couple interesting examples from research. This is a great study that was done in 2017 entitled Temptations for the Expert Witness. And great advice for all of us. Remaining humble will help experts present themselves as, and I love the way that this is phrased, calm and confident teacher whose job is to explain honestly to triers of fact the evidence and logic that support each opinion. Isn't that the way you want your expert to testify? Isn't that the way an expert can avoid ethical issues in the courtroom? They're not going to be tempted to embellish. They're not going to suddenly find more evidence or more arguments just because they just suffered through a withering cross-examination. If they're humble enough to appreciate that their job is to, with a strong foundation, be able to talk about the facts of your case, they will remain this calm and confident teacher. Here are some of the lures that may come up for your particular expert. Now, here's the challenge for us. We're going to know this. We're going to know about these lures in preparing our expert because we're going to learn their personality. You may already know their personality. Maybe you've used them before. Maybe you've been lucky enough to be able to watch them testify in other cases. You can tell when an expert is argumentative, narcissistic, emotional. You're also going to know when you can do them a big favor and make sure that they are reminded not to testify full of expertise. They talk about lawyers using legalese. Well, experts use expertise. They've got to translate scientific language into straightforward, simple language for the jury and for the judge. You're going to want to know whether an expert is stubborn, whether they're going to dig in their heels, it's probably not going to always inure to the benefit of your client. And you're going to want to know what experts are or are not sore losers. These are just some lures that create this kind of testimony. Now, sometimes expert witnesses can create big ethical problems. I'll just give you a couple of cases you may want to look up and read a little bit more on your own, but I'm going to give you some of the relevant language here from some types of cases. There was an expert in this case, for example, that always testified with certainty. Now, that would be a big red flag for many lawyers that routinely use expert witnesses, because most of us know it is virtually impossible to get an expert to testify with certainty, because most fields of expertise don't lend themselves to 100% certainty. There's always that possible doubt. Now, jury instructions accommodate that, as do the instructions which tell you what kind of weight you can assign a different expert testimony. But this was a particular case where the expert always stated that the opinion rendered was, quote, indeed and without doubt. Now, most of us would never say that about anything, because there's always that sort of niggling, lingering doubt, whatever it is that we do and say. The dissenting opinion in this particular case was very instructive. And you know how it is. Dissenting opinions today might be quoted in majority opinions tomorrow. So we don't ever want to discount something simply because it's in the dissenting opinion, or even because dicta. We always want to read everything and consider everything. But this dissenting opinion was instructive in that it highlighted the expert's proclivity to, and some of us are Trekkies because we grew up in the 70s, and 80s, to boldly go where no expert has gone before. So that can be problematic. If you have most experts in a particular field, whatever kind of case you're handling, that sort of stay within certain parameters, they may disagree, but they're all sort of in the same lane. You don't maybe want to hire somebody without doing due diligence that is not afraid to boldly venture out of that lane onto the opposite side of the road, for example. The dissent also talked about what the court should or shouldn't have done. Again, it's a dissenting opinion, but consider the wisdom of thinking through whether or not allowing an expert to take the stand and say anything, basically saying, well, you know, the other side can cross-examine. Is that enough to be able to draw the sting? Is that enough to overcome the potential weight to a jury of expert testimony that shouldn't have been allowed? At least that would be the argument. In this particular case, an ethics committee of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences concluded that the expert had, quote, misrepresented data to support the testimony and presented testimony outside the relevant field. So we always want to make sure on the front end, and there are plenty of cases that talk about cases like this, where you have experts that are beyond the guardrails, and what lawyers should have known, should have done, what courts should have known and should have done before the fact. Now, it's also important because psychologically, expert credibility depends on certain things. So it's almost like ethics and credibility are all tied together in terms of what kind of an expert you should call, when they're going to be given the best type of testimony. And it's a mix of knowledge, confidence, trustworthiness, and likability. How about that? Now, many psychology studies really reiterate this reality that many of us know instinctively. We trust people we like. And your jurors and your judge are going to like expert witnesses that testify in a fashion that makes them likable, and they're going to trust what they say even more. It's also true that we've looked at the extent to which the manner of testimony is important. And the same study found that the highest rankings of credibility or persuasiveness were linked with, get this, a moderate degree of competence. So testifying that the opinion is indeed and without doubt, as in that last case, isn't necessarily going to come across as the most credible opinion in front of a jury. This study found that overly high confidence can actually detract from an expert's impact on the jurors. Here's low and high measures of confidence, by the way, if you want to know what this looks like and sounds like. Low confidence is erratic tone of voice, alternating pace, excessive hesitations and pauses. We often imagine this is true if you've ever cross-examined your teenager as to why they came home late. Asking for repetition of questions, slouching, fixed eye contact, where high confidence in terms of credibility is often manifest in high, loud volume, rapid pace, expressing absolute certainty, sometimes assertive or combative mannerisms, good posture, leaning forward. Now, here's some indicators of medium confidence. And according to that study, at least, that's where an expert may be most credible. And by the way, think through that maybe this is when we might be most credible as well. Stable tone of voice, clear speech, moderate pace, elaborating on details. After all, if you are an expert, you are able to easily elaborate because you know a lot about what you're saying. Acknowledging the limitation of knowledge. You don't know what you don't know. Your expert doesn't know what he or she doesn't know. There's nothing wrong with that. Nobody knows everything about everything. So the ability and the humility to be able to explain the guardrails that bind your opinion, nothing wrong with that. Nonverbal indicators are important too when your expert testifies. Consistent eye contact, straight posture. One thing you want to make sure is that your expert hears and answers the questions correctly. Now, you're thinking through all of this when you are cross-examining the opposing counsel's expert as well. And as I go into the home stretch, let me just say, you know, when we were all young, we thought this was going to be us. We're just going to eat that opposing expert alive. We're going to know more about their field of expertise than they do by the time trial rolls around. Not so much in practice, because unlike whatever opposing expert is testifying, you didn't go to school to be an engineer, a doctor, a psychologist, or a mechanic, whatever it is, whatever kind of case you're handling. The best you can do is know enough about how the facts of your case can be helped by knowing how to cross-examine. And when you do, keep in mind ethical rule 4.4 that says you cannot use means. Think about the kind of questions you might be tempted to ask in cross-examination. You can't use means that have no substantial purpose other than to embarrass, delay, or burden a third person. Let's just stop there for a second. So you've got the example of being able to cross-examine an expert witness on relevant information. Maybe there is something in their past that a judge rules, got to flesh this stuff out in limine, that a judge rules is going to be relevant because it goes to credibility. Great if you have something that's legally admissible. But you can't ask a question that has no legal relevance and is just embarrassing. So keep this rule in mind. By the way, all these rules have great comment sections that I think you should look at because they give some practical ideas of how this rule could be applied. This rule also goes on to say you can't use methods of obtaining evidence that violate somebody's legal rights. And that would mean somebody you're investigating, whether it's an expert witness or whether it's a third party witness or anybody. This rule is applicable to respecting the rights of any third person. So make sure you keep this in mind as well. Also remember, an expert can prepare you for court. They can tell you what they are often asked and what the issues are and what the contrary science often says. They know, especially if they testify a lot. So you're able not only to prepare them, but to be very open and willing to be humble yourself and learn what you can learn from your expert that'll help you know what to expect in how they're going to be cross-examined. It's a wonderful thing to be able to have that synergistic relationship, that chemistry with your expert witness. And by the way, your jury is going to be able to know and perceive how well you know your expert. And there's nothing worse after court, after a trial, usually after an adverse verdict, to have a jury say, it didn't seem that you really had met that expert before. Did you prepare beforehand to put that person on the stand? Make sure you never get that comment, because you're prepared enough with your expert to have a very good back and forth, very good chemistry as you relate the testimony to the jury. That also makes for great testimony. It's great. You do a great job for your client. So one thing we should want to know is, you know, we do have this idea that we want to seek to interview all our witnesses. We shouldn't do it in a fashion that's intimidating. I've listed for you in your materials a lot of these standards simply so you can learn the kinds of things that are important to consider. I'm not going to read them all to you here, but go through and keep this all for reference material to understand all of the different facts and considerations that go into the kind of relationships that you should have with witnesses. And it's important to go through these also because, you know, these are the types of things you're going to be thinking through when not only you're preparing your own witness, but you're also preparing your witness in terms of you having a witness there so you're not called as a witness if there's an allegation made that you did or said something to unduly influence what your expert was going to say on the stand. So it's always good to go through all of these and take a look at all of this. All right, so let me just talk about in closing what your ultimate goal is in deciding, you know, ethical rules and expert witnesses. Your ultimate goal is thinking through on the front end all of what these standards say, all of what the model rules say in order to have an expert witness testify in a fashion that doesn't run afoul of anything that may be used against you ethically and legally. In other words, you want that solid foundation. You want a solid scientific basis. You want to be able to prove that you on the front end researched your expert witness to the extent that you were confident that the expert was competent to testify, both legally and ethically. You want to make sure you have looked and considered all of the different ways in which your expert could be cross-examined. And you also want to make sure that you've done all the research that you ethically and competently need to have done on the other party's expert. All of this can be done proactively so that you're not surprised in the courtroom and you're not surprised by the verdict. So the ultimate goal in using experts wisely at trial is what I put in the title, effective and ethical use of expert witnesses. So I hope you've enjoyed this presentation. It has certainly been a pleasure to spend some time with you. I wish that we could be in person, and I hope I do see you in the future in one of my future in-person seminars. Again, my name is Wendy Patrick, and this has been Legal Ethics, Effective and Ethical Use of Experts. Best of luck to all of you.